But it does give me great pleasure to welcome, and I want you to do a massive big cheer, to welcome to the stage Mr. Simon Reeve and Mr. Paul Goldstein.
Here they come.
Come on, Simon. She's still got it wrong.
They're like a big entrance, everyone. Come on, everybody. Woo-hoo! Come on, gentlemen. The stage is yours.
Wow. Are we seeing... That's a... Keep going!
Hurry up! Come for Yeri Dorak. Come on.
Let's get comfortable.
Coming the wrong way down the road.
Get off the road! Come on, son, put your back up.
You're saying the Burmese troops are hiding just round the corner?
They just saw now.
So we're now at the front of the whole raiding party. So we're speeding through the traffic now, and we're in a proper pursuit sort of situation.
They're telling us to get down. This is what they think is a cartel safe house.
Now that it's drilled in, now we're going to show you now how to use this.
Yeah, the boat is...
Is that a real gun?
Yeah. You come in here, do you want to have some?
No, I'm quite enjoying it.
Suddenly, the mood changed. The men started jostling us and demanding money.
Is that enough of him? I think we've all seen that, haven't we? Simon Reeve, everyone.
Thank you.
That's a lot of you. Haven't you all got jobs to go to or something? That's a lot of people here. Good. Look, you're going to have your own chance to climb into Simon, and it's my turn now for a few minutes. How many of you saw Sacred Rivers? Show of hands. Be polite now. That's the whole audience, Simon. That's fantastic. Do you know, very interesting, I'm sure there might be a few of you who are staying on for the next interview with Leveson Wood.
Now, let's just talk about... Here who thought this was going to be Leveson Wood.
Yes, there's a lot of them here. Yeah. Now, the Nile. Leveson walked it. Fine, yeah. You flew over it in a helicopter. It's not very tough, is it? Listen, it's a little unfair, actually. And I watched...
No, it's not.
I'll start the way I mean to go on. I watched all the Three Rivers programmes. I struggle. Each time I saw one of them, I thought, this one's better than the other one. But seeing as I haven't been on the Yangtze, I've been on the other two, understood. But the Nile clearly affected you. I mean, there were... I mean, you drank it and it affected you and you were in hospital.
Yeah, but there were bits like that as well.
There were bits that distressed you enormously, particularly that dam.
I think there were bits... Sorry.
Yeah, sorry, go ahead.
No, don't continue.
No, it's all right.
But I think there are bits of every journey that I've ever done that have... affected me and indeed distressed me. Is that working? Have I got it? Do I have to have it in my mouth? Is that working? Thank you for nodding. Appreciate it. So, absolutely. The Nile affected me in every sense, and there are positives and negatives about that. But everything is an experience, if you like. I think the one that really tweaked my buttons, if you like, was the Yangtze journey. I was really blown away by China and the Chinese, actually. You say you haven't travelled in China at all.
I've travelled in China, but I haven't done a Yangtze journey.
Okay, well, I hadn't really travelled in China at all. I tried to travel through it. This is very helpful, actually. Well, most of it. But following
yes,
the...
Unfortunately, the door.
The door does slightly ruin some parts. Quite a lot of it, in fact. But I'd followed the Tropic of Cancer and Capricorn around the world and the equator a while ago. And following Tropic of Cancer, we tried to go through China, and the Chinese government was having a bit of a strop with the BBC and didn't like us, so they stopped us. So following the Yangtze was one of my only chances to travel through the country. And as I say, I was properly blown away by it. I thought they were magnificent, eccentric, perfectly bonkers, good sense of humour, loved it, and them. I was really impressed.
Not often the view we may get over here.
I think that's the point. I think I saw...
I'm quiet on my criticism,
no,
as you know.
But, no, absolutely, you shouldn't be. But I think while we should be critical of what's wrong, I think it is the case that a lot of what goes on in a country like India, for example, if that was happening in China, the world would be up in arms. And the Chinese have managed to do some extraordinary things. They have lifted hundreds of millions of people out of poverty in recent years. Yes, they're destroying a lot of the wildlife on planet Earth. Yes, there are huge human rights issues completely. But you can't take away the achievements from them because they are magnificent. And it is a country that is changing in positive ways. So I was really impressed.
The a part of the program that immediately springs to mind is when you you didn't don budgie smugglers, but they weren't far off, and you went for a swim. And how was that? I mean, suddenly there...
A swim? I was watching this. Yes.
It was you, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was. Yeah, no,
it wasn't
that.
A body double.
Sadly not, no.
But, I mean, one moment I saw it. I mean, was it cold? Was it? I mean, that current looked fearful.
And okay, so Paul...
You got some pretty good... some heckling, the far bank, I seem to recall.
It was encouragement, I think, rather than heckling.
Yeah, sorry.
So Paul is talking about my rather foolish decision to agree to take a dip in the Yangtze River while filming Sacred Rivers. And we were in a city where... Chairman Mao rather famously swam across the mighty Yangtze River.
Many times, wasn't it?
Many times. And
you did it once, didn't you?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And he, in some small way, used it. I can reach you from there. he used it in some small way to cement himself politically. I mean, it was such an act of masculine...
Well, look at Putin now. He's always big macho. It's
now,
a similar
exactly.
thing.
And I did make some smart aleck comments about Putin doing that. They cut out for some reason.
Yeah.
But anyway, so I got into the water with the local swimming club who emulate Chairman Mao's swim. And while my team, the rest of my camera team, were fiddling around with batteries or something, trying to get things ready, I'd swum basically a third of the way across the river. I'd been carried mainly by the current. And I was just supposed to potter around, but I got a bit carried away and nobody stopped me. And Dominic, the producer, was in a tiny boat saying, "Stop, Simon, you must stop. It says on the risk assessment you won't swim. Stop." But in a very half-hearted way, and so I carried on.
He knew he had it was.
It was fun. And I think, you know, all of us, if we do something that's a bit challenging, we get a great sense of achievement out of it. And it's not the widest river in the world. It wasn't the most epic thing, but I was very
perhaps
proud of it.
Not the cleanest.
It wasn't the cleanest, but it was a lot cleaner than, I tell you, than the Nile and the Ganges. My goodness. I took a dip in the Ganges as well, and just almost as a blessing. And I did that in Haridwar, which is one of the holiest cities, of course, in India. And there was a slight bit of concern about the level of fecal contamination in the river at that point. But it's better than when you get downstream, so I thought do it earlier, slightly safer. And again, just got a bit carried away by the moment.
I think, talking of the Ganges, how many of you have been to Varanasi here in the...
Look at that!
Okay, well, that's a lot of people who need to go. It is the most extraordinary city. And I must say, the first time I went there, I was put off it slightly because I went on a desperately organized excursion, which got down to the river far too late. The sun was well out. And I thought, I actually felt like it was not intimidating, but I felt it was intrusive. So the next morning, I was up at 4 and got down. And exactly as I saw you do, I just thought that was... It clearly affected you. But it is the most extraordinary place that you can have a burial. I always remember in one photograph, there was a burial, washing, and a class of something, and then cricket going on the top ghat, all in one sort of view. It is an extraordinary... in one frame.
That's what you want, really, isn't it?
Yes,
I'm sure you'll know, but Paul is one of our greatest photographers, but he's also quite obsessed with getting up ludicrously early to catch the light, as camera people love to say. And people like Paul are constantly dragging me out of bed at a ludicrous hour in the morning because they say...
Don't read that wrongly, please.
People like Paul because they say we've got to get there for first light. And they are right. I know they are, but I do like a lion.
Well, actually, strangely, in Varanasi, a lot of you know Varanasi. Sorry, that was a bit posh. Varanasi. Like, I come from Fulham. No offence to anyone who lives in Fulham, but you get that mist, just that sort of industrial mist that drops down. But when that
Let's
sun
not think of it
breaks
as industrial,
through,
yes.
No, sorry, just mist.
Just
ethereal. Holy Ganges.
Yes.
It is sacred. But I just think the thing that struck me extraordinarily about that was that burial routine, that they will wash it first, the body, in the Ganges, and then try and set light to it. And that's why these things go on so long.
It's quite a
simple
lot of
science, yeah.
But I think it's to go to somewhere like Varanasi and witness life in its absolutely raw state. It is such a privilege to be able to do that now. And the number of hands that went up of the people who've been there, my goodness, to bear witness as much as anything to acts that have gone on for generations. Incredible thing. Amazing place.
I think I read, when I know I've got to interview Simon, I always sort of go online and look for reviews. That's what I really want. And I want to immediately see one star or something. I think that's going to give me some info. And actually, quite the contrary on this. I think it was the Guardian journalist who said, you make boring things interesting, which I like. Because a standard stretch of the Blue Nile just flowing across it, it's like, yeah, it's a river. You know, we know it exists. What you said about that dam and what you said about the water being apportioned from the 18th century or whatever it was, I can't remember exactly the date, all going to Egypt.
Yeah.
I mean, this is a powder keg. And exactly, by us, in colonial times. I think that's true.
And I think it's very easy for those of us who live in the comfy, cozy parts of the world to forget that actions are a generation before took have major implications in the real world today for much of the planet. And you know, our lives move on and we imagine that everybody else can, but they're living with the reality of a line that we draw on a map or a completely arbitrary, really, apportioning of water that we decided on. The dam that you're talking about, this is one of the epic building projects that's happening on the planet now.
Where's the money coming for that, by the way?
A very good question. In loans that we don't get into the finances, obviously, but in loans that I'm sure are entirely transparent and regulated.
Yes, they will
completely
be.
Completely so.
Anybody, you want to look those up, you'll see.
I think it's very nice. I mean, I like that comment, boring stuff interesting. I think there are very few boring things in the world. It's a fascinating place, obviously. But I would say, when you're making a tele program, obviously you've got a major advantage that you've got what's going on in front of you. You've got what you can say about it. Crucially, you've got what you can look up afterwards and add into the commentary as well. So we spend a lot of time trying to shoehorn in sometimes factoids and information that we hope will be interesting. And one of the big arguments I have with my colleagues is I'm always trying to add more. And if I see a bit that I can talk over, they'll go, don't talk over that. It's a beautiful shot. There's lovely music. And I'll just write something in here. And I was at the BBC for about 9 hours yesterday. And we were scripting a new series I've got going on. And I sit there with two colleagues, and we row and we bicker, and eventually we agree, and it's all part of a great process, but we're putting in as much as we possibly can. It's only an hour of telly to travel, in my case, to travel the night. I know Leveson did it at a slightly more appropriate
level. Yeah, it's even saying the difference between the two of you and your look on the Nile. Of those three programs, was there a particular time that you were actually distressed by what you were seeing? Something that really got to you and you thought you felt helpless? You feel, am I really, you know, bringing anything to this?
I think you go to the sort of the core of one of the challenges of travel, really, when you're confronted by poverty or injustice or whatever it is, or a combination of the two, even worse. That's a deeply upsetting moment. I think when you're a traveller, it's perhaps easier, in my own life anyway, when I've been a traveller, it's easier for me to deal with them than when I'm there with a TV crew, because we feel more of a responsibility to try and do something about it. You know, people there expect more of us because we are a TV crew, you know, and in reality, TV is just a ripple. It's just a ripple on a large pond, a lake. There's not a lot we can really hope will be achieved by anything we do. Maybe people will see the program. They'll see something in it. It will chime with them. They will feel moved by it. I've certainly had a lot of emails from people who say, I've seen your programs. I've been very touched by the situation in Uganda or in Paraguay. I went to work there as a doctor, for example. And that's an amazing response that you get to the program. But I'm constantly upset, moved. I'm a bit of an emotional wreck from the things I've seen and experienced. I'm sure you've been through it.
Mothers
try to give me their children when I've been on some journeys to try and give them a better life.
Don't do that with me.
It brings a lump just thinking about it.
Yeah, it's I think that's the correct answer is what I feel for that. It is. I love it when, just when I thought I had enough to ask Simon about, I picked up the Evening Standard this week, and in the magazine there was a quick Vox box about his... And you know you're talking about him, and it said, your favourite bar. And, you know, if I was answering that, I'd say the local sort of dog and parrot or down wherever it is in Tooting or what it is. And this is the petroleum bar in Kazakhstan. Is there anybody here who could...
I'm sure people have here have been to the petroleum bar
Actually, has... In Almaty, sorry. Almaty. Has anyone been to the petroleum bar in Almaty? Please say no. Or someone lying, help relieved. Him out. That, see, there you are. That is itinerant one-upmanship on a whole new level.
Come on,
which he's magnificent. Sorry, that's
it.
A big thing.
It's a vice prop. I've got to come up with something. I can't say the Holly Bush in North London, can I? It's about world travel. Yeah. You want to move on? Sorry.
He could say that.
You carry on.
Quite easily. Thank you, sir. I'm going to move from... stick with water tenuously. But right. How many of you watched the repeat? I'm sure you saw it first time round of the tea trails and coffee trails recently. Good.
Thank you.
The rest of you all saw it before, I know that. This one fascinating. I watched them both. I saw them first time, but I noticed a change. I've known Simon quite a few years, and I noticed a change, particularly in the tea trails, that a certain stiffening of the presentation and really going for what I suppose some things went inescapably wrong on what I saw there, particularly the tea trails. I mean, I saw you what I thought was... almost scared in the Salgar, which I've driven through in Kenya, where that truck stop where you couldn't leave because there are bandits, and you look genuinely pleased to get out of there, even though you'd done your hard yards with certainly those care workers and the prostitution there. That must have been, I mean, desperately upsetting. I mean, you've experienced this before.
I personally wouldn't say that anything, almost anything I've ever seen is 100% right or 100% wrong. Everything, I think one thing that my journeys have made me realize is everything is in the shades of gray. And yes, of course, at the place you're talking about, this is a truck stop on the tea trail, on the route through which our tea is brought to us out of East Africa. It's a truck stop which doesn't really exist on a map. There's an extraordinary amount of prostitution there servicing the truck drivers who stop there. It's a very dark place. There's a lot of sadness there. But people in the rest of the world, they don't live our cozy lives. They don't have our welfare state. They don't have the entire civic structure that they do. They struggle. They grab at what they can. They endure. They survive. And there are people there. There are women there who are working there as working women who know full well that what they're going through and enduring is not good. But nonetheless, it's better than alternatives. They're able to provide for their families. They're able to put food on the tables of their children. They're single mum working as a prostitute, whatever it is. This is the reality of life on our planet. What we should take away from it as much as anything is not just their suffering, but how incredibly fortunate we are. And never forget that ourselves.
I think the... I've got to say, I'll put my hands up. I found it distressing, and I've seen this so long. I've been traveling to that part of the world for 25 years, and you know, to see a lady who earns 300 shillings, which is about a couple of pounds, and she can manage to get that payment, I think she said, 8 times a night. I mean, it is absolutely chilling because she has 5 children. Goodness knows who the fathers are. It was distressing. And then to go on to the... And this is something which I was gratified to see, not only the way you investigated the child labour... in place in Uganda particularly, but also the fact this huge march of fair trade produce now, which 5-10 years ago just didn't exist, and now it is a massive, massive market. And there is no question, because it's now priced competitively particularly, you know, most of us who go in will buy that out of choice. Is that not true? I feel that, and to see that highlighted,
everybody should be nodding.
Yes,
yeah.
Yes.
We highlighted it, I think it was fair and justified. You're talking about two programs I did, Tea Trail and Coffee Trail, that have been shown a couple of times. And they're slightly more, I suppose, I mean, they're not really investigative, but they're based around a particular subject. And obviously, we explore that. I go on a journey. That's what I do. And we tell a tale about the tea and the coffee and where it comes from. And part of the tea story, most of our tea comes out of East Africa now, which is why we traveled through across Kenya into Uganda. Sorry, I've got my back tea around here, by the way. Apologies. Nothing personal. So we traveled across Kenya and Uganda. And yeah, part of the big story of tea, as you say, I think, in particularly in recent years, is the growth of Fair Trade and Rainforest Alliance and organizations like that. We did pretty well in this country, actually, to give ourselves a pat on the back. You know, we generally do seem to give a damn about the fate of our brothers and sisters on this planet. We're prepared to pay a few more pennies. The pressure we've applied to supermarkets are obviously generally only in it to make money and will give us whatever we want. It's forced them to make our tea and coffee and things like that generally fair trade. There's a lot more we can do, but always choose it when you can, because there are millions of people out there who scrabble around picking our tea for not very much money, quite frankly. And if you met them, as I'm sure some of you have on your journeys, I'm sure Paul has and I did, you would want to pay. You would want to pay for fair trade and for Rainforest Alliance and things like that.
I think it was. I like the program. I like the way you started in Mombasa, then went back to the actual where it starts. So just a quick question. This ties up with something else. You were in Mombasa for a while filming. Did you feel perfectly safe there?
I don't think you ever feel entirely safe.
I live in South London, by
around.
The way, just the reason I asked that question. And it's just a message to the Foreign Office to please stop your spiteful travel warnings. The Telegraph described Simon as someone who goes where the Foreign Office doesn't like. Which, of course, their warnings are never—they're never politically motivated. Or
no, but they
like
have.
That.
You know, it's a classic case. They've got to watch their backs, haven't they? Somebody will sue them if they've said it's okay to go.
They can't sue the Foreign Office.
I found Mombasa. The people have tried. I find Mombasa pretty safe. I find the world pretty safe. It's been the great surprise to me since I started travelling. You know, fairly extensively for the BBC, particularly just over 10 years ago now. The world is not as scary as a lot of the media would have you believe. You know, we're traveling. We go with a very, very expensive camera that we wander around in back streets and alleyways. And we've touch wood, etc. We really don't get many problems like that, to my surprise. We don't really get hassled, frankly, either.
Simon's well qualified to answer, well, more qualified than most, certainly, to answer that. You saw a little bit of it there, but especially that when you're with those Ugandan troops, with the African force, with Al-Shabaab firing shells just over you. I mean, that's sort of stepping into the war correspondent.
I don't know about that. I have done that. I've been in some very difficult places, and you know, before coming to TV, I wrote books on terrorism, so I've had some fairly tricky experiences in life and professionally. But I'm not setting out to be a war correspondent. What we have tried to do in the programs I make is incorporate light and shade into them. I don't think it's fair, frankly, to ask BBC license fee payers to give me a very large sum of money to go on some jolly where I just go and look at the nicest hotels in the world. What we try and do, you're talking about when I went to Mogadishu, or traveling around the Indian Ocean for a series of the same name. We try and incorporate both aspects. You know, this is a world where the Seychelles are not far off the coast of Somalia. And it's important to incorporate both those into our understanding of the world, and we try to incorporate those into the journey. And from the start of when I came up with the idea for the Indian Ocean series, it's not the hardest idea, big map on my desk. Where's Lord Palin been? Where are the crumbs I might get from his table? You know, Indian Ocean hadn't been done. It's an incredible journey, but it did take us through both extremes. Seychelles, Maldives on one side, the problems of Somalia on the other.
Yeah, I think I've worked in this travel caper for many years, and I speak to Simon from time to time, because he's the perfect... The question I'm always asked is, what's new, Paul? Where should we be going to? And most places have been discovered. And also, unless generally you've got a half-decent flight network there, people aren't going to go in any great numbers. But he's the perfect person.
No, I'm really
to
not.
Ask. Yeah, I think you are.
What's upcoming?
Or... Yeah, well, I get asked it the whole time. I seem to recall, you know, even areas of East Africa, which people normally think I don't know about that. I mean, we get such a misconception from our media reports.
We can do. I mean, I think that's partly because it is a rather big world and we only have the capacity to listen to so many things, and inevitably news, if it bleeds, it leads. So inevitably that's what you're going to hear. Where's coming up? Oh, goodness. People are everywhere. We collectively, as travellers and as a species, we've gone and we've been everywhere. And I realised that coming through the jungle of Borneo years ago and properly parting the ferns and finding a Saga coach party there. That's an incredible...
Nothing against Saga.
Not at all. No, it's an extraordinary thing. You can go almost anywhere. What an amazing time to be living. Mm. And I hope we all remember what a privilege it is. Mm. I mean, of course, if you go to places where there aren't 7 international airports, you are more likely to have an off-the-beaten-track experience than if you go to somewhere that does. So, you know, my wife drags me, kicking and screaming as I do, as she does, to an island called Symi off the coast of Rhodes, for example, in Greece. There is no airport on Symi. That means it is not as touristy as Rhodes. This is fairly straightforward. Paraguay, incredible. Namibia still doesn't get that many visitors,
frankly. There's no direct flight. Not
extraordinary.
Anymore,
yeah. No, Australia's big enough to swallow all of us. You can go... You know, I think it's a bit risky to start thinking, I've got to go where people haven't been. You know, sure, go where your neighbours haven't been, but people have been everywhere. And let's not think of that as being a bad thing. It's not some sort of game where we've got to try and... beat somebody else's tally.
And also that people develop. There was a lovely bit in the tea trails when you were with the Maasai and that particular lady, senior lady.
Lucy.
That's right.
What an incredible woman.
Wasn't she fantastic? And then I just love the fact that she was talking to you very eloquently, and then she reached for her smartphone. It just kind of came out of the rope, which was fine, you know, and it wasn't... what I loved, it wasn't remotely patronising. And then you picked up that she was talking avidly, and then you realised she was talking to someone 100 metres away.
She was about half a mile away. So we're on the Great Plains of Africa in the sort of cliché...
A couple of lonely bossier trees and acacia trees, and it was perfect.
Exactly. We were with the Maasai, and we were with... a grandma called Lucy, who was in ceremonial Maasai outfit, and I just helped her to mud dung her hut. I mean, it was a slightly cliche.
You need some work on that.
I do. Yeah. You're right. Yeah. It was a plastering course or something. Yeah. Anyway, it was a bit of a cliched sort of scenario, but Lucy was not a cliche. She was one of the, and it's not often that you meet people who are as fascinated by the big wide world as you are by their world. But you do meet them, and you do meet them. And she wanted to know all about us, our families, where we were from, why we were doing this journey, where we'd gone, where we were coming from. It turned out she just sold a cow, so her daughter, I think, could do a tourism course at a college 100 miles away. You know, in another life, by an accident of birth, she could have been a barrister, I mean, or something. Just extraordinary woman. And yes, her phone rang, and Jonathan, our cameraman, oh, goodness, he's got to put the camera down. You know, keep filming. And it really was her neighbour half a mile away.
Fantastic.
I could just see, who are those white blokes you're with? What are you doing? And that was just the conversation. It was
superb. And I've spent, you know, so many years of my life around Maasai. I just find this a fascinating thing. And as a tribe, they are changing.
Yeah.
I mean, I speak to Maasai who are...
Not by choice, often.
Some of it is. I find the savageness of... And as we're finally getting a case in this country of female... Sorry, to touch on something very touchy, very sensitive, female mutilation. Younger Maasai now are not having anything to do with it. I mean, it is slowly getting through. And it's not anything we can do, but it is with the right money and the right NGOs. It really is making a difference.
It's like so many things, isn't it? People don't change when you tell them to. They change when they tell themselves they must. I mean,
exactly.
If we'd learned that lesson.
That really was, for me, that was an utter high point. And she was far better with her phone than I was. There was no selfie with Simon, but anyway.
There's something you get now, and I don't know if you've experienced it, but I've been to a number of places where there's actually cell phone coverage, but no electricity.
Yes.
And you can be in the remotest place, and I've bedded down in huts in villages where three people have got phones, and they will take it in turns to walk 10 or 15 miles to somewhere where they can charge that phone and then go back. But they still get cell phone coverage in their village. And that's one of the... I mean, it's been quite transformational in parts of Africa, in more remote parts of Asia. They haven't had that... They haven't put in that whole expensive landline infrastructure. They've just gone straight to mobiles.
It's helping them.
It really is.
I'm going to go for a bit of mobile upmanship here. About a year and a half ago, very, very early as ever, and I drove up, and exactly what Simon's talking about, and it was right in the middle of the plains, and there's an acacia tree, and it was misty, and it was almost dark, and I thought, yes, that's what I'm looking for, and there's this sort of blob on one of the branches. I thought, leopard, fantastic, that's our day sorted, and we drove a little closer there, and I looked even through the Swarovskis should never lie, and I thought, oh, it's got a kill up there, because I can see some blood or something, this is going to be, and of course, drove another 300 meters Acacia. And it was a Maasai up this acacia tree, because that was the only place he could get signal on his phone. It was just magnificent.
Did you just name check your binoculars?
What? No.
I never lied.
I did, yes. Yeah. There are other binoculars available for full recommended prices, yeah. Please. Now, listen, everyone always talk. So if I'm not allowed to say where's new, what are you going to do? I know the answer to this question.
I mean, I'm just not I'm not an ex-travel expert.
Not the
like
Oracle.
Simon Calder or somebody it's like that.
That's Simon. Where next? What are you doing next?
Oh, yes. Okay.
Yes, I'm looking forward to this.
This is
so
our cue,
for all of you
guys,
who really earn a crust, who really work hard, you've grafted, you've taken a day off, a precious day's leave to be here. What are you doing next, Simon?
Okay, so I've got a series coming out in a couple of months that Paul is... Are you all right, Paul?
Yeah, I'm fine.
Remain calm,
yeah.
Okay? It's called Caribbean, okay? I know it does sound like a very tough gig. I'm hoping that are they called audiovisual geniuses, basically, aren't they?
Oh yes,
they might be able to play a trailer that we got together, and hopefully now.
Oh, look at that! It
I'm
works.
On a journey around the Caribbean Sea.
God, it's
with its
desperately hard.
Beautiful islands
and an incredible mainland coast, home to millions of extraordinary people.
This is a vast area with a rich and brutal history.
Some of the most dangerous...
Oh, is that helicopter again?
It's one of the most vibrant and exciting regions on Earth.
It's the Caribbean.
Oh,
no. Hasty bloke.
On this first leg of my journey, I travel east across the Caribbean Sea. From the island of Hispaniola to the American territory of Puerto Rico. In the Dominican Republic, I'm picked up by the officers battling drug pushers and cartels.
That is a block of cocaine.
I come face to face with the reality of living in America's backyard.
Quite peaceful and still down there, apart from this massive bomb.
I cross one of the poorest countries in the world and get a warm welcome at a voodoo ceremony.
And this is a real treasure of Haiti.
We'll all watch it, though, won't we? We will.
Thank you.
Very pasty, Simon.
So I'm not there to get a suntan,
I'm good job, too. I like the spray-on sweat in the early bit to show you're grafting. I'm fascinated by the Haiti section there, without too much of a spoiler alert, that it is one of the... Anyone been to Haiti here? Okay, that's two.
Well good, done. Well,
excellent.
Did
okay.
You enjoy
that's
it,
that's more than a drunk at the petroleum
did you
bar.
Did you go to the Citadel?
There you are. Perfect.
Can I just explain what we did?
Yes, yeah,
Before I get the question.
The
tomatoes, yeah. You know?
Yes.
So the idea with it, as I say, with all the journeys I've tried to do, is a bit of light and shade, not just a jolly at your expense. We do not forget you have worked hard for that, of course. The idea is I travel round the Caribbean Sea. So although it looks like a fairly small area of the planet on this giant map, it is a million square miles. And I go round, we start on what I call endlessly the exotic island of Hispaniola, and we travel through the Dominican Republic, which some of you may have been to, we travel through Haiti, into Puerto Rico, around the sort of paradise islands in the Eastern Caribbean, Barbados, etc. We travel round to the mainland coast, and then we went up the Caribbean coast of South and Central America, so through Venezuela, Colombia, into Nicaragua and Honduras to finish in Jamaica. And, you know, as I said earlier about the extremes that you get in the Indian Ocean, you possibly get even more extremes in the Caribbean. There was one day we were diving in Honduras and we were helping some scientists. I was helping some scientists in a rather muppety way to catch and then take samples from parrotfish, which are, of course, absolutely essential to the health of our coral reefs. And it's absolutely spectacular. It's the second biggest coral reef in the world. Incredible. And then the next day, I think it was the next day almost, I was walking into the gang wing of a Honduran prison in the city that is... Oh, it's got the hairs going.
Yeah,
It's the most dangerous city in the world outside of a war zone. Honduras is taking a hammering from the drugs war. And we went into this gang wing of the prison where there are no guards. And I went in two colleagues and the bishop of the city had to come with us as our sort of guarantor, our security.
For anyone who's been on the Northern Line this morning, you know how it feels. No.
And it was unlike anything I've done. It was the scariest, meanest looking men I have met on planet Earth, covered in the gang tattoos of the Central American gangs and loads of tears down some of their eyes, indicating how many people they'd killed, people who'd skinned people, horrific stuff, and utterly surreal because on the most frightening gang wing, MS-13, I don't know if any of you have heard of that, with some of the top leaders of the gang. The guy who I was talking with, the gang leader, what he really wanted to show us was the nativity scene that they had built from recycled objects, and there a bloke was turning up the next day who was judging Honduran prison nativity scenes. It was completely and utterly surreal, but that is our world, quite frankly.
They two things that came from that. You, when you were frisked, do you look like you were getting out of that? You're going to get the whole marigold treatment there.
No.
What happened there?
That was in the Dominican Republic, and we were with the SWAT team, and we were watching them training and doing a bit of training ourselves. I think this is quite an early version of the program. It's mainly clips
they
just from the first program,
yeah.
And so we'll add stuff from the other programs in soon. But yeah, it's just meant to illustrate life as it's lived. So I don't know if you saw me in what I was told originally when we were planning it was a flying boat, and then we got there and it was a flying dinghy, but driven by this lunatic Frenchman. I don't know if anybody's been on it. Any tourist can go on it. Any traveller, it's in the Dominican Republic. Anyone been on a strange French bloke's flying dinghy on holiday in the Dominican Republic? No? Okay. Do it. It's possibly not entirely 100% safe, but nothing ever really is, and incredibly, incredibly memorable. He just sits there on the beach waiting to take people up, and I get really bad vertigo, so it was quite an experience.
The bomb. The bomb. So it was a bomb. Okay, it just looked like a big load of rust to me. But
in the clip, probably does. Yeah, I mean, you don't see the timer ticking away.
The Tom and Jerry.
We're a little under 30 meters of water or something. But that's off the coast of an island off Puerto Rico. Absolutely, paradise place. One or two bombs littering the seabed. I wouldn't suggest you go diving on them. But part of my gig is to do that, and I embrace it.
What? Give us the plug. We will be seeing this when?
Give it a plug. It's called Caribbean. It's on the telly in a couple of months. If you watch it, I'd be very grateful. Thank you very much.
That was a fairly soft plug. We'll allow it. You want questions?
Yes. We've got 10 minutes to go there, Paul.
We've got 10 minutes, so we're gonna cram in as many questions. I'm going to do the umbrella trick. If it's either only one question, I hate it when someone... I've got three for you, Simon. So we're going to have a show of hands. We've got the magic microphone.
Who wants to go first?
Who's going? We've got a gentleman there in the sheepskin.
I'm going to run to you, sir.
In a flying jacket there.
He loves this. He really does.
Thank you.
Hello.
I just wanted to ask you, please.
The microphone.
Of all the people you've met in your travels, who, as a race, struck as being the happiest people?
What? I've never been asked that.
Thank you
for that brilliant question.
Very good. That's the standard, everyone.
That's a good question. That is a lovely question.
So I don't know if everybody heard, because there's a bit of cut out there, but the gentleman's kindly asking me, of all the people you've met on all your travels, Simon, who seem to be the happiest people? And this is a really interesting one, I think, because I can bring a few facts to this question, because the people who regularly top the poll... And there are serious polls done on this of who are the happiest people in the world. It's the Danes, and it's the people of Vanuatu. And it's possibly for similar reasons. It's possibly because, without too much of the ludicrous science in it, their income disparity is fairly low in both places. So they aren't constantly seeing people driving down their high street in a Lamborghini and swanning out of restaurants with a mink round their shoulders. People don't flash the cash in either place, so nobody really feels, oh, I must aspire and acquire in the way we perhaps do in our community and culture. So my wife is half Danish, and she drags me to Simi and to Denmark a fair old amount, And they are pretty chilled and relaxed people. I have discovered fairly recently, it might be because they are, I think, the number one consumers of antidepressants in Europe, possibly in the world.
That might have something to do with it.
But nonetheless, those Scandies, they do all right, you know. So I would say them. But, you know, there is an old cliche, of course, about how we go to difficult parts of the world, to poor parts of the world, and we come back saying, oh, they're so happy. You know, yes, they have nothing, but they dance so well and they're such jolly people. Obviously, it's our ludicrous take on their lives, and they'd quite like to have our fridges and our electricity
and our flying jackets
and a bus and our flying jackets and our, a bus to get them to work. But nonetheless, there is a degree of truth in the fact that when they're not confronted by loads of wealth, they don't aspire to it and they don't desperately try to grab at it, perhaps as we do to a certain degree. But great question. So Danes, I think you will get a sense. They call it hygge in Denmark. This is the absolute core of life.
We've got any Danes here? Anyone from
they're
Denmark here?
They're too happy
in Denmark, is what it is.
So hygge, which is like their sort of the cozy feeling you get when you sit around a fire in winter with your friends and you have a nice warm experience.
Okay, that's a brilliant question and good answer. Vanuatu and Denmark, I wouldn't have picked that. Who's next? We've got lots. We've got one over here. Oh, right in the corner.
Hello.
Hi, Simon. How are you?
Hello. Ooh,
can you hear me?
Yes.
You do all these amazing adventures and you go to lots of dangerous places, but how do you cope coming back to the UK? Do you ever feel sort of like come down to earth with a bump, or how do you just sort of deal with being back in normal life?
Thank you. Great question. Thank you very much. How do I deal with coming back from my glamorous swanning off around the world? I think, you know, it's... I was talking to a friend on the way here, and he's just come back for an incredible trip to Ethiopia. And he's not a professional traveler. Well, I'm not saying I'm a professional traveler, but it is my job, you know. He went out there with his missus, and they had an incredible, incredible time. And there was something in his voice that meant I asked him this. I think he's got back 3 days ago. I said, you're still on come down, aren't you? And there is an element of that, I think, probably for all of us. I get it the same way anybody who goes and has an incredible experience will get. You know, whether you're getting married, after the birth of my son, that was the biggest one. How do you process those emotions from experiencing something absolutely unique and incredible, magnificent, you're going to remember forever? Well, it's tricky. You know, digital cameras help with that, don't they? Take a lot of snaps. Doing this, quite honestly, really helps. It's such a treat and a privilege to be up here gassing away about the journeys I've done. I get, you know, to put a little DVD on the shelf. I did that. That's a lovely memory of it as well. But my family, my friends, they bring me down to earth very rapidly. Yeah. You know, I don't come. Has somebody got the car ready? No.
Oh, I have to do practice, that, don't
I?
Yeah.
So I came back from the classic being. I came back, I think it was Tropic of Cancer, came back from traveling. That was 6 journeys around the world. It was a pretty epic experience for all of us involved. And, you know, I work with teams who've worked on all the other much bigger, better tele travel programs and Tribe and with Lord Palin, and you know, they've traveled the planet, Bear Grylls, etc. And it was epic, the journey we did. And we got back, and even before I had unpacked my bags, I had to rod out the sewers at home. And that was, I always remember that. That is classic.
Yeah.
Down to a reality check. Okay, deal with it. You just have to, you know, you just have to accept that's the reality, not those amazing trips, you know. And embrace both. I really think you've got to come back, and when fresh water comes out of your tap, you've got to be grateful for that and recognize that that's something special that your ancestors couldn't have imagined and most people on the planet can't as well. So thanks for the question.
Yeah, it's a good question. And conversely, don't you hate those people when you're abroad and you're eking out every little bit of enjoyment or experience or passion, and they say somewhere towards it, oh, I just want to be home now. No.
How they say, oh, it wasn't, you should have been in the Congo.
I know, yes, yeah, it was much better 20 years ago. Yeah. Same about music. I preferred their earlier stuff. Yeah. I think he's doing almost calisthenics with his arm.
He's
there,
desperate.
So we have
here
to come.
Here we go,
to
sir. What do you fancy saying?
Maybe quite a personal question, but have your experiences on your travels made you want to adopt a religious faith?
Interesting. Have I found a soul? Gentleman is asking. I think it's made me more open to the idea. I mean, I was brought up as a Methodist, and you know that's about as opposed to any sort of fundamentalism as you can get in many ways. I think, you know, I was just dragged to church by my parents, really. I didn't have much of a faith then. It waned and I lost it by the time I was in my mid-teens. Before I had got this bizarre telly gig, I used to write books, and I wrote several books on terrorism. I wrote one about Al-Qaeda and Osama bin Laden in the 1990s, and I met a lot of people writing that who believed far too strongly in things, and that put the fear of God, I was going to say. In some way, that's true, quite frankly. My experiences have made me slightly nervous about and concerned about anyone who believes too strongly in anything, because life is so much the shades of grey. It is so rarely, there's so rarely certainty about everything. And, you know, I'm at each end, so I don't entirely believe the scientists who say, oh, no, this is definitely the case because I've lived enough of a life to know that in 5 years' time they might say something differently. And I don't believe, oh, this is the only faith in the world and this is the only religion, you must believe in it. I'm jealous of people who got that faith, quite frankly, because I think what we all want in life, what we all need more than anything is perhaps purpose and meaning in our lives, and often people get that from faith. So I wouldn't say I've found it. It's made me more open to it. I've enjoyed talking to people out about their beliefs, crazy or otherwise. And I wait for the moment the light shines down and I'm given that chance, but it hasn't happened yet.
Let's just have one more. You watched his pilgrimage program, I'm sure. We've got a question. The lady at the corner. Penny, it's you. Penny, please.
I'll get through there. It's like a maze.
I didn't just make up that name. I do know her.
Sorry, Madden. We've got time for one really, really quick one.
Yes,
a quick one.
Okay? And really go for the jugular, Penny.
Where do you wish you were now?
Where do you wish you were now?
Where do I wish? Ooh. Honestly, I'm not somebody who travels to get away from these islands or my family. Terrible weather, around with wife. I really, really do not. I travel because I think it is the best, or a magnificent way, certainly, of racking up the most incredible and memorable experiences. I mean, you look around us now at these stalls and what they offer, the chance we have now to go and embrace these incredible moments in our lives. So I travel to get that, but I'm always really happy to come home. I think this is a magnificent, fairly large island, in fact. I love my clan. I love my family. Yeah. I'm not looking for any sympathy, but I'm quite happy to be back. You know, I'm very, very blessed. I know that. I don't come from a rich, travelly family. I didn't get on a plane until I started working. People didn't travel when I was a kid the way they do now, and I don't take it for granted, frankly. I think it's an enormous privilege. So I haven't got blasé about it, and I hope to keep that what is sort of genuine enthusiasm. I've also got a mind like a goldfish, so I forget. I keep going round and round. Oh, wow. It is sort of genuine. Thanks for the question.
Yeah, thanks, Penny. Good work.
They're
giving me these signs around. Firstly, so much, everybody,
thank
for coming.
Thank you for popping over. We're all standing around at the bar. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, that is. We're all going to watch Caribbean, aren't we?
I'm having me back.
Okay. Hands up, who's going to watch it? Of course we are. No, because, listen, I just add a caveat to making boring things interesting. He also makes interesting things fascinating. He goes so much beyond just the surface of these countries, which so many other glib, pretty boy presenters do. He really does a job in it. And I will continue to watch. I will. Simon, again, thank you very much.
Thank you very much indeed, mate. Thank you.
We'll be blogging and posting recordings of all the events live each day, so check back for more.